This is Congress Two Beers In. I'm Josh Shooter, Senior Fellow, with my colleague Matt Glassman.
Hey, coming live to you from Annandale, Virginia.
That's exactly right. And we don't know what we're going to talk about today. So we're just going to kind of fire around because like, there's a lot of stuff going on in the house.
Yeah.
And it's a bit much to get your head around because there's so many different dynamics and factions kind of at play. So, Matt, you wanted to sort of like suss this out a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you're seeing in the house right now, the underlying issue here is that you have a razor-thin majority, and more groups are trying to leverage that because there's different factions that seem to have different interests in what the House does between now and the election. And some of it is substantive policy, and some of it is positioning for campaigns and concerns about those things. And some of it is dealing with entities outside the House, the Senate, the President, right, who have different ideas about what they want to happen. But that seems to me to be the underlying feature here, is that we have a very small majority, and that means any handful of Republicans can sort of leverage the situation. And on top of that, people are now willing to do that, right? We seem to have thrown off any restraint among a variety of people from just saying, no, I'm not doing it. And so we come into, you know, this week in the House with a big agenda. I mean, we should might as well just list it off, things that are like sort of sitting on deck that different factions are thinking about, starting with sort of the leadership and like, you know, the House and Senate. Yeah. And so one of those things is the NDAA, the Defense Authorization Act, is sort of hanging around Congress, right? Another thing is this proposed reconciliation bill. But what does that mean? That's a process. What's in there is some amount of funding for DOD, right? Maybe just extra money for DOD outside of the annual purpose process. Maybe a war supplemental to cover the cost of the war
like
with Iran.
$10 billion for the SAVE Act.
Right. And then we have sort of the SAVE Act hanging around, which is something a faction wants, more election security measures. We have a farm supplemental, right, to bail out farmers who were sort of byproduct injured by the tariffs, right? And
in addition to that, we have the farm bill, which expires in September 30. They're going to have to figure out either extend that or, you know, find a way for the Senate to pass the farm bill over the next month or two.
We have a set of members who want to do some border security things that are sort of vaguely outside of all of this. And we have other things that are just moving or not moving because they're getting caught up in this problem, like the veterans bill this week. We also have nominations going on, which are on a separate track that may crash and burn. So the shape of this is strange. But I think what's going on is that no one has the ability right now in the House to set the agenda and say, this is what we're doing.
Well, that's not entirely true, right? I mean, Mike Johnson has the ability to set the agenda. And one of the things that really strikes me about Johnson's position here is that he can't set the agenda despite all of these kind of factional disputes. This is something that like previous speakers do a lot. You kind of log roll, right? I scratch your back, you scratch mine. We'll pass the NDAA. We'll try to pass the SAVE Act. We'll try to pass the border security bill. And when we pass the border security bill, maybe you'll get the, you know, the farm bailout, right? Or, you know, something along those lines. And what's interesting to me and what I can't quite put my finger on is why he's not attempting to do that a little bit differently. It doesn't seem like the deals are being struck. And what might be the case is that none of these bills have a majority, right, to pass. And so essentially what he's trying to do is log roll a bunch of bills where the people who want something are not willing to vote for the other thing that they would be required to vote for, whether that's a National Defense Authorization Act, whether that's, you know, the SAVE bill in the Senate. And so he's in a really bad spot. Not surprising with this majority, but it is surprising that these deals are not done, right? You would think that there'd be some space somewhere, be like, hey, you're going to have to eat something that you really don't want right now. But, you know, that kind of teamwork and camaraderie that, you know, that you would see in a normal or in a, you know, a majority for the last like 30 years is sort of gone in the Republican Party. Yeah. They all seem like a lot of free agents. And that gets back to your first point about how they're getting reelected. I mean, there's been so much fragmentation going on. You know, we talk about like nationalization of politics and like there's less local news and there's less local interest. And I think all of that is totally true. What I think we are still struggling to understand, especially in like political science, for example, is how fragmented the media environment is affecting politics. I mean, all the podcasts, like the thing you're listening to, right? All the YouTube influencers, like all, I think there's a totally different media environment. And it seems to be having an effect because there's some very niche coalitions asking for very specific things that nobody else in the conference seems to care about or want.
So it strikes me that we're sort of off the rails from how you might approach as a speaker. Again, my view is that the very narrow majority is a huge hindrance here, and that's not rocket science, but I think the mechanism is interesting. I think typically a speaker or a leadership who has sort of the deference of their coalition is going to approach it like this. Coming up to an election, they want to protect their majority makers. And it doesn't matter if it's Pelosi or John Boehner or McCarthy or Speaker Johnson now, they're going to tend to do things that help the people who are in the tough elections, mm-hmm. right? They're going to tend to set the agenda in a way that sort of sets them up to maintain control of their majority.
Yeah.
And in a typical situation in the House, if you have a cushion of 20, 25 seats, what you can do there is you can let the people on your flank, on your right wing or your left wing of the Democrats, they can vote against the stuff. And they can bitch and moan about how it's not really what they want to do, with the understanding that what you're doing is helping the majority makers. Two problems I think I see with that right now. One is that they can't vote against it. You need the votes in a lot of these cases. They're not going to be able to vote against it. Second is that the president isn't being very helpful here because the president seems to be lined up with some of the factional groups, especially on the SAVE Act. And that is not the usual orientation. Usually an administration aligned with the leadership in the House would be encouraging them to protect the majority makers and sort of giving them the cover and telling the SAVE Act right-wingers to shut up. Yeah. And the exact opposite is happening right now. And so I think those are sort of impingements we're seeing. And the narrow majority has, I think people have learned. I think there's been an evolution in the House where small groups have learned. Look, one thing I think is really important to remember is if you have, even if you have a 20-person faction that wants to do something the leadership doesn't want to do, it's really hard to hold 20 people together in the House.
Yeah.
The leadership only has to buy up a couple of them. They don't have to offer a lot to buy you away from a 20-person faction. But when you only need three people to do it, it's a lot easier to just tell them to F off and jam things up. And we've seen Luna take advantage of this. We've seen sort of the Freedom Caucus people take advantage of this. In theory, the moderates can take advantage of this too, although they haven't done it as sort of overtly. But that's a problem. And again, I don't think Johnson can operate in the way a normal speaker would operate here.
No. I mean, and I think the reconciliation bill is kind of a perfect example of this. I don't even see this as like a real policy push, to be quite honest with you. It really looks like sort of trying to play like defense, right, in a lot of ways. This is like, you know, England in the World Cup. They get a lead and just trying to like hunker in and like, we'll just protect this lead. And the stuff that's in there sort of makes sense. You get money for farmers. You have defense money for the defense hawks. You've got the SAVE Act for the president and the sort of right-wing factions. And it just sort of like looks like coalition management. I'm trying to appease the administration. I'm trying to appease conservatives. I'm trying to get defense hawks on my side.
But you create a fire because the one thing you don't do is offset it, and there's another faction, which is the people who care about this stuff, but really what they want to be, either for substance or for show, is budget hawks.
Yeah.
Right? And so where are the cuts to pay for this? And you can see, you know, Warren Davidson and that crowd screaming about this. And are they a credible threat? Maybe.
Right.
Are lots of people making credible threats and following through in the 119th Congress? Yes.
Yeah.
And so you have to be ready for this to all collapse on you.
Yeah. One thing that is really striking for me is that it seems like this gets harder and harder this year. Because, I mean, we are in July of 2026. We are 100 some odd days away from a midterm election. There are a bunch of primaries still on the docket that are upcoming in many of these states. If you're not in a primary, you are in full campaign mode for the general election at the current moment. And so like making a promise like, yeah, this doesn't have offsets, like has a little bit more sting to it than it did 12 months ago, right? And so like you can kind of of like take your position and sort of like just hang out and then eventually cave if you get something into the bill. That's not as likely here because it looks like you're breaking a promise right before the election.
Yeah.
Right. And election politics really do kind of throw this in for a mix. And so like the reconciliation bill feels a lot more like, you know, kind of a caucus conference management piece to me, simply because like a lot of these people are not going to back down from their threats at the current moment. Like, yeah. And if they're not, if they were following through with them before, they have even more reason to follow through with these rationalizations of their opposition now, because they're closer and closer to an election and they know that, you know, kind of flip-flopping on that sort of thing could bite them in a campaign ad.
Yeah. The other piece of legislation that's hanging around here is Johnson's floating right now the idea of doing a CR for the appropriations bill. And that is sort of a looming thing coming up for the election that may be the most important looming thing in some sense. I do think there's some strategies here that could produce some results for the Republicans. Like, I can imagine it being very difficult for the Democrats to vote against, say, like a CR sometime down the road that also has like a war supplemental on it. That's going to be a very tough vote. And my guess is that on the DOD funding, or DOW funding, whatever you want to call it, the $350 billion may be dead in the water, but some level of money that ends up being like the war supplemental something will get through. I don't know when or how, but that as a standalone vote is very tricky for the Democrats to vote against, or at least a lot of the moderate Democrats to vote against it. And that is impinged by sort of people like Luna, who just want the SAVE Act thrown on every damn thing.
Yep.
And from a leadership perspective and a procedural perspective, throwing the SAVE Act on this stuff just gives other people like the Democrats an out to vote against it. And if you can get this stuff lined up sort of on its own, you can create sort of the pressure you want and jam the people you want to jam. But you can't do that if you have people in your own party sort of forcing your hand.
Yeah.
And you can be like, well, why do they need Luna if they have the Democrats? Because Luna can block the rule, right? And the Democrats aren't going to help you with the rule if they see you're just going to jam them on the substance.
Right.
And this is sort of a set of particulars that is both sort of arcane, but like absolutely real. And we're watching it happen week after week where the House floor is just kind of shut down by people with sort of factional grievances.
Right. This also like really hurts the House relative to the Senate, right? If the House just wanted to pass a CR, jam them, leave town.
Yeah.
They can't do that if they have the SAVE Act because they know it's coming back, right?
Yeah.
The SAVE Act already failed the Senate. Previously in June when they tried the last reconciliation package, you had four Republican senators vote against it. So not only did you have a lack of 60 votes to waive the budget points of order against the SAVE Act, you had no majority to pass it at all, right? And so you know that that's coming back and you can't just leave town because you're going to have to vote on it again. But, you know, it's not a question, I think you're right, that, you know, Democrats will vote for a CR. I think they'll also vote for a war supplemental attached to a CR.
Or at least enough of them will that you can create your majority.
Right.
Yeah.
The question is, what does it cost Johnson in order to do that? And that's a big, big ask if you can't pass a rule to get this thing to the floor. Do you go to Democrats at the Rules Committee and work with them again? Like, that almost cost him his job in 2024.
Do you try and round up the votes for suspension?
Right.
That might even be there, but again, that politically does not make the people on your right flank any happier.
Right.
It just makes it look like you're pulling a McCarthy 2023 style governance in the House, where all of a sudden the leadership looks like it's more engaged in a bipartisan coalition than in a Republican coalition.
Yeah. I mean, and this is the same problem that Johnson had in 2024 with Ukraine aid and the appropriations bills. So, I mean, it's not like he's in foreign territory here. It's just that, like, it'll cost him a job, possibly, right? Or at least, you know, the next speakership. He may be able to hold on with minority leader
That's not obvious to me, although I feel like a fair enough. And, you know, sometimes we talk about the re-election incentive for members of Congress, which is obviously paramount. But for leaders, they have their own re-elections in their conferences, and that's important too. And in some ways, you can read Johnson's moves here as trying to solidify his position within his conference. And, you know, I mean, you may have the idea, who the hell with this job? Who the hell needs this?
Right.
But Mike Johnson's, you know, if he is not returning as Republican leader, that's basically the end of his career on the Hill. He's not going to go become some powerful committee chair now. And so if he wants to remain in high-level national politics, he's got to maintain the minority leadership position if they lose the election, or the speakership if they win it.
Right. And this is what's so interesting about his, Johnson's spot. All his goals contradict one another. So it's like, on the one hand, you want to win a majority, right? Yeah. Not shutting down the government would be a kind of a primary case for that. On the other hand, you also want to kind of maintain your party's image, right? Well, his party's image is like very dysfunctional and very disunified. What are you going to bring to the floor that's going to unify Republicans? You want to forward or advance the administration's priorities. Well, the administration priorities, like arguably one, could cost you a majority if you try to push the SAVE Act on it, or two, cost your party brand, because a lot of people don't buy into like the election kind of rigged narrative.
It's interesting too, because you know, even right now, if you're focused on sort of like the median Republican, right, or the median House Republican, you know, there's a whole set of things that they are very behind, like border security, that if you're focusing on the majority makers is less sort of where you want to be. And the one thing that it seems like should be around now that would help the majority makers and unify the conference is some sort of tax cut or something. And you're just not seeing that right now. And that was a little surprising to me. And again, you have the people who want to pay for this stuff, and that's a problem on a specific factional flank. But if you wanted to protect the majority makers and sort of unify the conference, my initial thrust would be like, do something out of Ways and Means in a reconciliation bill on taxes. Now, you know, you still need a policy, but that's the spot where I feel like this 220, right, would have a shot to be unified in a way that helps your vulnerable members on the front line in the election. It ain't happening.
Yeah.
Right? So, some of that's the president, right? And I look, again, I bring a lot of this back to Trump. And two strands of that. One is, I think Trump is obsessed with something that is not palatable to the majority makers, the frontline members. And second, I think Johnson is beholden to Trump in a unusually strong way for a Speaker of the House. Right. And so there you go, right down the line.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the interesting thing about here is normally like Speakers of the House have their own sort of legislative coalition and backing, right? They have the confidence of the membership. They have the, you know, a majority behind them that's like solid. Whereas Johnson, in reality, only has his job because Donald Trump helped him get his job, right? I mean, they had to hold the speakership. He was not going to become speaker without Donald Trump putting his thumb on the scales, right, and pushing those holdouts.
And that's
holdouts
prospectively true for next January,
for sure.
Whichever leadership position he would be aiming at, be it the speaker if they're in the majority or the minority leader. Right. If Trump says you're done,
right,
that's probably the end of the line for,
right,
Johnson.
He's unusually reliant on the president to maintain his job. Meanwhile, in the Senate, John Thune was elected because he was not the Trump candidate, right? You know, the Trump candidate, Rick Scott, was one of the first ones voted out. I think he was the first one voted out. And then it was down to John Thune and John Cornyn. And it was pretty clear that senators did not want somebody beholden to the administration running the majority of the Senate. And so you have two very, very, very diametrically opposed leaders trying to form, like, run coalitions that have very, very different goals. And you're seeing that play out now, where it's like, oh, let's pass the SAVE Act, let's attach it to literally every policy that comes to the floor. And that's almost the only way Johnson's going to bring bills to the floor right now. They had to pull a veterans bill yesterday because of a variety of different factors. Meanwhile, in the Senate, they're like, that's a dead letter. It's literally, we will not pass that. It's very hard to see how they accomplish this for the president.
This is sort of like a very interesting incongruity too, because notice the substantive things Trump would like to get out of Congress right now, SAVE Act, and en route to that, ending the filibuster, both are complete non-starters right now. And pair that with sort of the political control over the leadership in the House, and you just have a real car crash with the White House here. And again, I some of this comes back to me to Trump's idiosyncratic nature, where he's never been sort of someone the Republican Party can count on to sort of bolster the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Part of that is he's an outsider. Part of that is Trump is very self-centered politically. But any president other than Trump, I can imagine my lifetime, would be sort of laser-focused on trying to maintain the House in the 2026 election, and I just don't feel like Trump is there.
Well, at a bare minimum, he'd be trying to hold the Senate, right? And it's interesting. I think senators are feeling the heat of the president's approval numbers right now more than members of the House are.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, you've got a lot of states that are underwater. You have a lot of competitive races that we did not presume to be competitive. The Senate majority, which many people did not believe was going to be within reach for Democrats this cycle, maybe. I mean, I'm still pretty skeptical that they flip the Senate. They would have to win some weird states in order to do that. But I think they are feeling the kind of like pressure of his public opinion, which is low. It's like the below 40 at this current moment in many of the polls that I'm seeing. Yeah. I think they're feeling out like more intensely. And so if there was ever a place that you would want to shore up and try to like back and support and give them like, what do you need in order to get reelected type of stuff, you'd be looking at senators. And that's honestly where he's feeling the most opposition at the current moment, because he continues to push policies that just they are not interested in at all.
Yeah. And Trump is obviously tied up in the SAVE Act and his personal grievances about 2020, but he's also sort of prosecuting an ongoing war that they just can't seem to get past. And I think most members of Congress, and you know, right or wrong, I think right correctly now, are focused on sort of pocketbook issues. And that doesn't seem to be where the administration is right now.
No. And, you know, the other part of this that I think is really interesting is, you know, we're going through another cycle of, you know, this reconciliation attempt, right? A budget resolution that appropriates money from by authorizers, right? It's not through the Appropriations Committee. And this has been something that I've been watching for, you know, it's been a few years now. But the kind of decline of the Appropriations Committee right now is sort of stunning to watch, right? We are watching in real time the Appropriations Committee lose jurisdiction over federal spending.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, this is historic. I mean, the last time we saw something akin to this was the 1870s, right?
Yeah.
Under Democrats and Republicans who did not like how the Appropriations was spending money on an infrastructure projects. Appropriations Committee ended up losing half of its bills, right, during that process, and it wasn't regained for another 50 years. And that's a huge, huge shift if all of a sudden the Armed Services Committee is doling out money to DOD.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if anything, if there's any space or where there's bipartisan cooperation, it's in defense spending. You know, it's almost always been there.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're going through this partisan process to try to do it. And it's a totally different committee that's making these decisions. So watching the Appropriations Committee yet again take another hit from, you know, the leaders just saying like, well, we'll just go around this because we don't care about the bipartisan process anymore. It's fascinating, stunning, sad to watch in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's and this is one, you know, I'm trying and failing right now to write something about this very topic. I see sort of a lot of the chaos in the House right now as a function of the narrow majorities and the president. That's different with this shift in the appropriations process, which I see as much more durable and much more sort of basically derivative of the increased partisanship. And I suspect unified governments going forward, regardless of size of majority, are going to take up more annual appropriating through the reconciliation process. I mean, they're talking about putting the CR into the reconciliation bill. And like that had never even dawned on me. I was like, CR in a reconciliation bill? You know, it's like, yeah. That's, you know, and these are new frontiers. And obviously with divided government, this doesn't really have a chance of happening because you can't really get a budget resolution politically through a divided government. So this isn't going to be all the time, and that may be the saving grace of the appropriators is that in divided government, they're going to reclaim some of this. But the speed at which more things are just being like, well, just dump that in a reconciliation bill. By the way, they're talking about reconciliation 4.0. You know, like, yeah. Oh, we'll do that in the next one, right? Yeah. Every time they can't give someone something they want in reconciliation, you're like, right. We'll do it in the next one.
Yeah.
And I was trying to count up whether they can legally even do a fourth reconciliation bill without setting some new precedents about how many budget resolutions you can have in the same calendar or fiscal year. And I wasn't sure I could. It was not straight in my head, and we don't have to get into it now in particulars, but I have it in my head that there is a limitation on the number of, or at least a precedential limitation on the number of budget resolutions you can do in a calendar year fiscal year.
Right.
Which is a weird thing to say.
Yeah.
But they must be coming up against that, and you can change the precedents and you can rewrite things, but you can't just do 19 reconciliation bills in one calendar fiscal year. Best I can tell, although that's just past practice, not any sort of law prohibiting it.
Right. And Yeah, I mean, it really does depend on, as they currently stand, it really does depend on what's in those bills. Or you can do a spending bill and you can do a revenue bill. Those can be
that,
separate
you
bills.
You can certainly do that in the same count or
from
fiscal
a single
year.
Yes. Budget resolution.
Right.
The question is, like, can you do another one? That's previously been ruled no, you can't do another one. And right. as long as the existing one exists, you can't, like, rewrite it, right? You can't, like, suddenly say, oh, we'll just do another one. My hunch is that you probably can rewrite it in some way, shape, or form. Be like, oh, that one is void, and now we can do something else, right? Yeah. That's just the way that the House and Senate work. But it's a really weird way to do things. And man, is the filibuster pretty stupid. You know, it's like the whole reason that we're doing this is because the filibuster is just so out of control.
Yeah. You know, the other dynamic I feel like we're seeing in the House right now is that something that I associate with the Senate, with people stalling one track of legislation or to influence a different track. Now, that's always been true in the House. This, you know, off-floor negotiations are cross-issue and you log roll things. But actually jamming up the House floor on something you're okay with just to sort of leverage it for something else that's not happening is a very Senate maneuver.
Yeah.
And seeing that come to the House is tough, you know, tough to swallow, because one thing that I've always sort of like laughed about is that, you know, the Senate would run fine on the House procedures, but the House would kind of be a zoo on the Senate procedures if you're empowering individuals. And that's because with smaller districts and more people, you just get more people who are willing to be, I don't want to say insane, but like not cooperate.
Yeah.
And sort of the norms in the Senate that enforce cooperation are more effective than they would be in the House. And the House is passed a lot of rules and adjusted their rules to sort of prevent wildcat nonsense. But with these thin margins, it's just very hard for if people have the balance of power. There's a, you know, I remember when the Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate for that short period of time between when Franken was sworn in and Kennedy died during Obamacare. And having 60 is kind of cool, right? You can do stuff without the other party. You can overcome filibusters. It also makes every asshole king. And like, you just don't want that, right? You just don't want that in some sense, because people learn really quick. And I feel like in the House, we're kind of at that, where people have learned quick. I do think if either party gets a 25-seat majority, things will mostly go back to normal in terms of a procedural coalition. I do wonder what happens if the Democrats have a 5-seat advantage. Do they start to see this factional sort of floor work by their own groups? My instinct is it won't be as sort of fleshed out and built the way it has been by the Freedom Caucus. But I also think in a divided government situation where not a ton is going to get done anyway, you could be ready for people to start silly seasoning their way to a lot of getting a lot of reps in of blocking the leadership for spite and things.
Yeah, I mean, like, just to go back to the last, I mean, there's a reason the House got rid of the filibuster in 1890. Right? Like, it existed in the House. It was very real. And finally, like, this has got to go. It was funny because after they got rid of it for 2 years. And then Democrats won the majority from Republicans. They reinstalled the old rules for because they had this massive majority. But once they lost some seats and it was a thin majority again, they got rid of the filibuster again, right? So the filibuster went away, came back, and then went away again forever, right? And it's stayed that way ever since. And it's because small majorities create this sort of situation where you can filibuster stuff, where things kind of look more like the Senate than the House. And to your point, like, I think there's no question that there are Democrats that are learning from what the Republicans are doing right now. And this is something that you see over and over again with congressional change and, you know, procedural change, whether that's norms or whether it's rules or whether it's, you know, one thing or another. You have this big change and it's like a monumental shift in the way that business had been done in the House. And then the big question is, well, what happens when the other party takes over, right? Great example of this. Democrats create a seniority norm in about 1911. They create new rules for committee processes. And Republicans are in the minority for the first time in 16 years, right? Yeah. So between 1911 and 1919, when they take back the House majority, all they do for those 8 years is bitch about seniority and the new rules that Democrats had installed. This is crap. This is terrible. They had a really, really, really nasty campaign against it in 1916, 17, and 18. And so the question was, well, obviously, they're going to come back and they're going to get rid of seniority. They're going to get rid of the committee system. They're going to bring back the powerful speakers or whatever. They got the majority back. back, and it stayed the exact same, yeah. right? And we see this happen over and over. Democrats created a much stronger speaker in 1975. Well, are Republicans going to keep that or ditch it in 1995? They made it even stronger. And the thing is, like, when you see these kind of patterns or these new behavioral routines take place and take root, it's often bipartisan, not in the sense that they're working together, but in the sense that they copy the yeah. other party.
Yeah.
And I would not be at all surprised if you see Democrats learning from this, not just on the House floor, but my question is, how much are they learning about who they install at rules, right? Is if Hakeem Jeffries wins a majority, are progressives going to allow him to just appoint right. anybody that he wants? Or are they going to demand somebody like AOC and a couple others?
I feel committee? Like on a narrow majority, I think that their base coalition would consider it malpractice not to do that
Correct.
At this point.
Yeah.
Not to do that would be seen as a complete abdication of their orientation politically. And the other key to this is whether these people on the left wing in the Democratic Party understand themselves the same way the Freedom Caucus does, in the sense that they understand themselves as not beholden to the party.
Yeah.
And not really built by the party. And I don't think the standard progressives really felt that way. But I do think sort of the new DSA types might feel that way, or at least enough of them might feel that way to be like, no, we have to leverage this. It's political malpractice not to.
Yeah.
And this sort of evolutionary learning where we're going to go again, if we go again coming from the left with the Rules Committee not under the thumb of the Speaker, you lock stuff in mm-hmm. right at that point, right? And again, I think if the Democrats win a landslide election and have a 24-seat cushion, Jeffries probably has a coalition of 218 where he can sort of just throw people in a meat locker and say, I don't care what you think. With a 5-seat cushion, I just can't see it.
Yeah. Well, this is the big question for me is, like, you know, that group of representatives who would be this kind of like anti-leadership bloc, 10 years ago, might have been 5 people, right? May have been 4, right? Like now, I think it's maybe more than a dozen. And we've had a lot of incumbents lose this cycle, right? This has been not a great cycle for incumbents, just like it hasn't been for Republicans on the right. You're seeing this a lot on the left. I think it's 5 Democrat incumbents who have lost their primaries, like Dan Goldman. Right. Kind of like standard, like, liberal Democrats who were just not progressive enough.
Yeah.
And you think those people are coming in, like, wanting to work with the leadership? Keep in mind, these progressives have won in spite of what the Democratic Party wanted,
yeah.
right? They beat the Democratic Party in order to win those races. And now they're going to be Democrats in Congress. Are they going to, like, just walk up to Hakeem Jeffries like, I'm a team player? Like, I don't think so, right? And so, like, the question is, how big is that coalition now, right? How big is that group of members?
And what's the balance of power?
Is it a dozen? Yeah. Because that's a big thing, right? And we're getting closer and closer to a point where you can have a 25-seat majority and you may not have a functional partisan majority anymore on both sides of the aisle, just because of the kind of, like, power that these outside and ideological groups carry in elections.
Absolutely.
Now.
And I think there's sort of a analogy mistake you can make here. Because Pelosi in 2019, when the Dems retook the House, had a coalition of 16 people, the balance of power, sign a letter saying, we're not voting for you for speaker, right? Those people were in the center,
mm-hmm.
right? They were the moderates,
yeah.
right? And they had all the reason
Marcia
in the world.
Fudge.
Right? They had all the reason in the world to get bought up, right? And fall in line,
yeah.
right? And they're going to get protected by the leadership, and they need the party to help protect them, and Pelosi's going to protect them. This is different. These dissenters will be on the wing like they are in the Republican Party right now.
They're closer to Mondami than they are to
Jeffries. And that's fine, right? There's nothing wrong with having different factions in your party. But I do think people have learned a lot from watching the Republicans. And the lesson isn't, like, some people might be like, well, the lesson is, like, this is just fucking chaos. But that's the lesson. That's the lesson if you are relatively happy with the center of the Democratic Party where it is,
right.
right? That is not the lesson if you are on the wing. The lesson on the wing is we can actually influence things
right.
if we stick together and force our case.
Right. And I think that I think many people in the Democratic Party don't like the center of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, they were like, a lot of Democrats were like, well, we'll kick him out. It's like, well, you want to lose seats. That's fine. like, Joe Manchin is the only Democrat that can win in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I don't know that there's really like a place you can kind of see it coming, right? The center of the party are going to be sort of like persona non gratas in the party if this trend continues, where ideological factions basically kind of hostily take over the parties.
Yeah. The other thing that I think people forget is that when majorities grow and shrink in a legislature, it shifts sort of the ideology of the conference in ways that you forget. Like the one I always talk about, people, is like when you get killed in a landslide, your conference gets more extreme,
yeah.
Right? Even though like you might think you might want to moderate, like you actually get more extreme because all the moderates lost.
Yeah.
But the opposite is also true. If the Democrats take the House, the people they're going to be adding are the exact people who have no interest in this progressive DSA business, right? And the orientation of the leaders, like Jeffries, their instincts are going to be to try and protect those people, which is going to put them more at odds with any radical group on the left. I do not envy the position Jeffries is in, becoming speaker on a narrow majority, because I
don't envy him becoming speaker in a large majority. It's like, I mean, Republican speakerships have been the worst job in Washington, D.C. for about 13, 14, 15 years ago, 15 right. years now or so. Like, Democrat speakerships coming right into that wheelhouse.
I agree. And you know, I was having a conversation with Jonathan Bernstein, political scientist and really, really sharp analyst of American politics, and he is not convinced that the left side of the Democratic Party is going to adopt this sort of hostile approach. He thinks people will fall in line, and it's possible, but man, on a narrow majority, I just don't see why they wouldn't.
Yeah.
Like grabbing seats on the Rules Committee, it's like you can grab the seats on the Rules Committee and then play nice, right? Like why wouldn't you grab the seats?
Right. I mean, that's essentially what's happening now on the Republican side, right? You've got people on the Rules Committee that can block the speaker from doing what he wants. That really stinks for him. But you also see like bills just aren't coming from rules, right? They're just like, they're not forthcoming. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, hey, we got this bill. It's like, where is it? It's like, it's probably stuck in rules and nobody's saying anything. Why is it stuck in rules? Because you have three conservatives on the panel. They're like, oh, that doesn't work for me.
I also think there's an interesting asymmetry in the parties that I think when Johnson can't get the stuff done because of his flank, he can go to the Democrats and get more honest brokering with them than the opposite. If Jeffries can't get stuff out of his left flank, when he goes to the minority Republicans in the House, I think he's going to hit a bigger brick wall, which is weird to think about, but I think it's true.
Yeah.
And so you may be in an even bigger squeeze next Congress. It's you know, can all this, maybe we won't be talking about this because I think it's also possible the Democrats might have a 20-seat majority or whatever. But you look at the numbers and like, they're just not, we're not in a situation where you're likely to have that big Boehner style majority, right? Like when Boehner was dealing with all this nonsense in the mid to teens, he did have, you know, he had that year where he lost 20 something votes for speaker, but he had the 28 seat cushion or whatever. It's hard to picture the Democrats or the Republicans with a 28-seat cushion anytime soon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they'd be lucky to have a dozen-seat cushion. I think that would be that's a great electoral return given the map and given the sort of like how many seats Democrats already hold.
That's also a plausibly manageable House from a partisan leadership perspective.
Yeah.
I think once you get down to five or six, I think you're just going to have to be giving away a lot. And again, look, you can be a master politician too. I think Pelosi or Boehner even might have had a better chance to solve the Johnson problem. I still don't think they could.
No.
I just think it's a numerical problem.
Yeah. I mean, Boehner couldn't solve the problem, right? I mean, when he had a larger majority. I mean, he was just run out of town, which they've done with every speaker since Boehner, essentially. So, I mean, I'm not terribly surprised by that, but we are getting to a spot where it's like, you know, the leaders of the parties don't really speak for the parties anymore. And you wonder how long their hold on the legislative process is going to last at this point. One of the things that somebody was talking to me about when McCarthy was coming into power. And like, what's the smartest thing McCarthy could do? I was like, well, he could relinquish power. That might be the smartest thing he could do. Just say like, you know what? Like, I'm going to broker some stuff and y'all figure it out, right? Sort of thing. Like, give, you know, like kind of take away the ability to like kind of decide everything by yourself. Because I think these positions are institutions that grew up in a different period of time, right? With different politics, where they were a little bit more unified behind the party. We're seeing like party brands just go into the tank. Nobody's really unified behind the party anymore. And I wonder how long speakers are going to stay as influential procedurally as they currently are. Like, it's just a matter of time, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, these institutions are pains in the ass, and they may be more durable than you think they are. So who knows? Especially like the filibuster. But I think that's about it.
All right.
So, all right, we're going to wrap up there. We'll be back in a couple weeks, talk more about what chaos has happened in the House and the Senate.
We'll know a lot more.
That's right. All right, until then, see you.